So I'm pushing back against the geometry from quantum. But to start, there's an ancient story that comes from India that tells of a collection of blind people who have never experienced an elephant. And one day, an elephant wanders into their village, and they rush out to explore the elephant. And one of them latches on with a sense of touch to the tusks, another one to the tail, another one to the trunk, another one to the head, you name it. And then they explore, touching it, and then they try and understand what this thing is. And they extrapolate based on the local model. And basically, after about a few minutes, they all start disagreeing with each other about the grand vision of the elephant. And then, of course, in the Buddhist version of this, they come to blows, and they start calling each other foul names. I think this is actually a pretty good metaphor for the research and the structure of microstates. We've all got a bit of it, and we care passionately about our bit of it. And that's why it is by way of a long introduction, a long thank you to the organizers, because it's precisely because of the meetings like this that we can actually begin to see each other's visions of what we're doing. Okay, so what I'm going to be talking about is basically the microstate geometry story. And rather than trying to give you the latest technical results, I just wanted to give you a bigger picture of where we are and where we're going. And first of all, I'll start by talking a little bit about why microstate geometries are very important and why they're important to the structure of black holes. And I'm going to illustrate these ideas precisely through the structure of microstate geometries and superstrata. Then I'm going to talk about the holographic dictionary for the superstrata, which we've now nailed down very well, which is extremely instructive. I'm going to talk a little bit about probing them and what is the same as black holes and what are different. And then talk about the hopefully sort of near future developments where we hope we can actually get some interesting ideas about energy exchange and viscosity as things fall in. And then there's a more technical issue about the gravity jewel of twisted sector states. And then most of what I'm going to say is about BPS microstate geometries, but we actually have some, I think, rather good ideas about how to get beyond get to non-extremal objects. Okay, so I should define what I'm talking about. A microstate geometry is basically something which is a smooth and horizonless solution to your favorite supergravity theory, the bosonic sector thereof, but looks just like a black hole from a distance, but then caps off. Then caps off in some smooth geometry before the horizon can form. And without horizons, basically there's no information problem. You can probe it just like you would a neutron star, although it's a bit deeper. The fundamental mechanism that underpins this is really all the singular sources that you would have in a black hole or an extremal black hole are replaced by magnetic fluxes through topological cycles. There's a geometric transition that removes all the singular sources, replaces them with topology and magnetic fluxes. And we now have huge zoos of examples of this. Most of them, but not all of them, are BPS. Okay, so the first sort of advertising is why you should care about microstate geometries, part one. And this is really embodied in a theorem I proved with Gary Gibbons a few years back. Now, it was rather more restrictively stated. It was in a particular number of dimensions. But it basically says, from the output of all the no-go theorems over the years, says that if you want to do microstate structure at the horizon scale, there's only one way you can do it, and it's using the microstate geometry techniques. So the sort of broader sort of idea is, if you've got yourself a black quantum system that you want to actually replace the black hole by, at some point, it better look like an astrophysical black hole somewhere above the horizon region, and it better have some gravity. Moreover, I think we now all sort of kind of agree that we better access microstate structure at the horizon scale. So therefore, it strongly suggests that your quantum system, whatever it is, should have a semi-classical limit that basically has some microstate structure accessible and not falling into the black hole. And the result of this theorem is to simply say, it better be a microstate geometry. More generally, there should be a more interesting class where you have these microstate geometries, and you look at quantum fluctuations or stringy fluctuations around them, and that's another set of microstate structure you can look at. I'll say more about that, an example of that later. And in the most optimistic case, or interesting, gravitationally accessible case, some of the coherent combinations of these quantum states should actually be describable within supergravity. And it's an interesting question as to how many you get. But the sort of fallback position is that there's still all sorts of stuff that you can study inside a microstate geometry. And in particular, you should really think of, if you don't want to go the whole sort of semi-classical route, you should really think of microstate geometries as a nice gravitational laboratory for looking at horizon state microstructure. Okay, so part two, why you should care about these things. And this rests on sort of 20 years of what we've learned from holographic field theories. And these are a class of problems we now have lots of solutions to. The problem is to start with UV CFT, and you perturb it somewhere. It's Lagrangian, you activate a state, and you ask, what is the infrared result of that renormalization group flow? What are the infrared phases? Are there multiple phases? What are the order parameters? How do the order parameters evolve? Are there new scales? Is there a mass gap? And how do you compute all of that? Well, we've got lots of examples, and I want to draw out some broader threads from those examples. Basically, the infrared geometry, often, not always, but often, the brains actually undergo precisely this kind of geometric transition I've talked about. And what happens is the magnetic fluxes on those brains are typically the holographic duals of the order parameters of the new phase. When you blow up a cycle, the scale of the cycle becomes the scale of that new phase. And the scale of the cycle plus the redshift gives you information about the mass gap. So all this to say, one of the most sort of meta lessons of this is that when you do this kind of game, you better not impose too much symmetry on the problem, because you might be forbidding the emergence of these cycles. You might be forbidding the emergence of the new infrared phase. You'd better activate all the appropriate infrared degrees of freedom, otherwise you're going to miss the order parameters. And often, but not always, the singular infrared geometry is the wrong phase, or you're obscuring the essential physics of the phase. And the archetypical example is something that I think Joe was the sort of first to give some really nice insight into, which was, you start with an N equals 2 and N equals 4 Yang-Mills theory, and you ask what happens when you turn on a mass and flow to N equals 1. And of course, you know, there should be chiral symmetry breaking and the emergence of some kind of gauge genocondensate. Now, there are lots of interesting but sort of failed attempts. The Girardello, Petrini, Perati, Zeffironi flow, too much symmetry, too few degrees of freedom. Kadi Zeitlin and Igor Klebanov came very, very close, but all of these were singular flows, and the sort of final real insight was Polchinski-Strassler and then Klebanov-Strassler. And what these were the correct holographic description of this flow, and in those limits, the first attempts failed because they imposed too much symmetry and they suppressed essential degrees of freedom to get into correct infrared physics. And as I said, the particular point here is the magnetic fluxes in this instance are precisely dual to the gauge genocondensates. The scale of the cycle that emerges is dual to the SQCD scale. And the scale of the cycle plus the redshift gives you the mass gap. So this is the wrong physics, too much symmetry, too few degrees of freedom, and the right physics. So microstate geometries are all about trying to do the same collection of ideas to the black hole problem. And what I'm going to do is just illustrate how far we've got with doing exactly this with essentially the Stromer Giavafa microstates. Right, but let me step back a little bit. The black hole I'm going to deal with is the one that Stromer Giavafa sort of started with. It's the D1, D5P system. It's got a nice macroscopic horizon. And basically, the idea is that when you turn on finite G-string and you impose spherical symmetry, you get a nice big fat black hole. Trouble is that it's got an information problem, it's got no scale, it's got no mass gap, so the only scale it's got is the size of the horizon, and the degrees of freedom are completely inaccessible. And I contend it's the wrong infrared physics. Only because you've chosen spherical symmetry, you're only going to see the thermodynamic average. The correct answer, in some sense, is the microstate geometry, which has none of the above problems. Okay, so let me explain what we're doing. There are two basic mechanisms for making a microstate geometry, one of which is the sort of older method, which was extremely powerful, but it didn't give us enough holographic information. But basically what you do is every singular source you see in the problem, you replace by a cycle, and put a magnetic flux on it, and basically the Chern-Simons interactions give you the original charges back in terms of some kind of carefully chosen magnetic fluxes. So everything becomes topology. There's a sort of halfway house that we found extremely powerful called the superstratum. In fact, I think I first talked about it here quite a few years ago. What they are is you do a sort of halfway house. You blow out a couple, at least one topological bubble, and you only need one, but you can add momentum charge by putting a momentum wave around the bubble. It's still beautifully smooth, but you can actually create these geometries. This, the holographic dictionary, is still an open problem. We don't know what the infrared field theory is when you have multiple bubbles. We have some ideas, and I'll say more about that. This, however, we've now, in the last few years, really pinned down the holographic dictionary. We know exactly what states they're dual to in this sort of D1, D5P system. And so that's what I'm going to talk about first. And just by way of a comment, and I'll again return to this, there are hybrids. You can imagine adding momentum waves to multiple bubbles. We don't know what they are, but we'll talk about that a little bit later. Okay, so superstrata. So I'm going to remind you of a very familiar story, but sort of just by way of introducing the sort of picture and notation. The field theory we're dealing with is D1, D5P system. You've got open strings stretching between the D1s and D5s. There are M1, N5 Chan pattern factors. So you should think of that as really M1, N5 copies of a C equals 6 theory. And the simplest Ramon ground state is to consider each piece separately. But it's an orbifold, so there are lots and lots of ways of twisting these things together into collections or strands, as they're sometimes called. There's a strand length. There are fermion zero modes, so you can mess with the spin of the ground states. But this is a sort of complete picture of the quarter BPS states with full force supersymmetry. And the gravity dual of this, the simplest way of describing it, is to pick one of those states, all of them distinct, one length one and n of them, with the maximum spin, and it's simply, the gravity dual is simply ADS3 cross S3. So we're dealing with this holographic field theory. And then, if you want to mess with the fermion zero modes and twist it, it involves turning on some modes on the sphere, but nothing terribly more exciting. Okay, but what we really want to do is we want a black hole with a macroscopic horizon. And that means turning on some momentum. So the momentum wave is going up to the left, if you like, and these things have, you keep the Ramon ground sector in the right sector, and you have the momentum on the left, and as a result, you can then do what Strominger and Laffer did, which is count the number of states of this system. It's the standard application of the Cardy formula, and you get this magic number, 2 pi q1 q5 times qp. Okay, at finite string coupling, you turn this on, and you get a nice big fat horizon if you keep it spherically symmetric, and you find the same area, or quarter of the area, is exactly the same number. You declare victory, and that was 20-something years ago. However, this has got too much symmetry, and I want to tell you what the story really is. So the superstrata states are sometimes the states that we call the supergraviton gas. I think Jan de Boer coined this term. But what they are the following. There's a right-moving Ramon ground state, which I don't really care about here, but I want to show you the particular class of left-moving excitation. So we have some particular spin state, or the Ramon ground state, with a particular strand length, and you've got order n of these things, so think infinitely many, but close to. And then you can excite it with certain particular modes, L-minus ones and J-minus ones, in those sectors with various powers. So from the point of view of supergravity, and that's the strand thing. From the point of view of supergravity, what you're doing is you're adding momentum and R charge. There's the R charge, there's momentum charge. But the supergravity, you get a whole bunch of geometric modes, infinitely many of them at the perturbative level. So, and basically you have huge numbers of these quantum numbers. These are the angular momentum modes on the sphere, and this is the L minus one or energy modes. And so what you're doing is you're turning on a vast number of spherical harmonics on the sphere. And you want to know how that back reacts. So that's what we can now do. And if you're on the coherent states, you better have the occupation numbers all large. And so what you can do is, this is what superstrata are. They're the precise back reactions of this lot. And I want to point out what we're talking about here is, you've got all these modes of arbitrary Fourier coefficients. So they're supergravity solutions based on functions of three variables. And in fact, there's at least two of them we can construct with two such functions. But actually, there's a recent realization, which is an immensely powerful computational tool. It turns out this is kind of, it's not, almost toric. The whole thing actually turns out to be governed by holomorphic functions of three variables, and those are the holomorphic variables. So in fact, these geometries are remarkable in that they are organized in a very nice way. Still not terribly easy, but still quite doable. Okay. And so we've counted the superstrata, we've counted these states, and we come close with just with these semi-classical modes, but no cigar. What you're shooting for is this. What you get if you count the superstrata, at least Masaki counted them, you get the right central charge piece, but you get too few momentum states. And that's because you're only looking at these L minus ones and J minus ones on a particular sector. But there's a lot of entropy, just not the black hole entropy. Okay, so what are we missing? Well, what we're missing is the twisted sector states of the CFT. And as I say, I'll come back to that in a few minutes. But what I want to do is talk about the structure of the geometry, because it's actually pretty nice. So I drew this cartoon before about turning on some wiggly modes on here, but when you backreact this thing, you wind up with something that looks exactly like flat space at infinity. Then it transitions to this BTZ or BTZ, whatever, throat, and then it transitions to an ADS3 cap. So here's the capping off before the horizon. The horizon's infinitely far down the bottom. And there are some important scales. First important scale is the scale B, which is associated with the momentum charge, and the scale A associated with the angular momentum charge on the thing. And what happens is that when your R is much, much bigger than M1, N5, or Q1, Q5, then basically you're out in the flat space limit, the harmonic functions are all one. But when R gets of order B, you transition to this ADS3 BTZ sector, and so long as R remains bigger than A, it's basically BTZ. And then, when you get to the R is of order A, you encounter all this complicated momentum wave stuff, which then start, once you pass through it, it transitions back to ADS3 times S3. So it's as smooth as you could want. You can do all sorts of cool things with it. And the other thing also is we tend to work in the low angular momentum limit, where A is essentially very, very small, and that means you have a huge redshift. So we can make these things with huge redshifts. We've studied a lot of properties of these things, but that's the sort of generic structure of the superstratum when you gravitationally backreact it. Okay. Now, there's a very simple class. I just want to advertise this one. This one has many miraculous properties where you just do something very simple with a single node. Turns out this massless wave equation is actually separable in this, so you can analyze the hell out of it. But I'm not going to go there. What I want to point out is something sort of rather mundane, but it's going to be important for what I say next. In the supergravity parameters, you have these A, Bs, there's a mode number N, but there are supergravity parameters. But there's something that's going to turn up and become very important in a minute, which is all the stuff about the compactification you're messing with. Planck lengths, volumes of the compactification torus, and so forth. And that turns up in the calculation because the supergravity parameters are related to the quantized parameters precisely through this weird combination of volumes. Okay, so the first thing, I'm not going to talk about scattering off this thing, although we've done some calculations of that. What I want to do is talk about something much simpler. So when you first do the most naive probing of these microstate geometries, and this is something you learn in your first gravity course or general relativity course, you do look at geodesic deviation. So what you do is you drop a whole pile of time-like geodesics into the geometry, you introduce a deviation vector that's set to 1 meter to start with, it's space-like in the laboratory of the infalling guy, and you ask, what's the relative acceleration between neighboring geodesics? And the thing that depends on this thing, which is sometimes called the tidal tensor, but it's basically the Riemann tensor contracted into the four velocities of the beast. Okay, it's orthogonal to the four velocities, so it's actually space-like, and so there's a well-defined norm that tells you how big the tidal forces are. So what I want to do is actually look at the size of this tidal tensor when you start dropping things into the microstate geometries. Well, that's the goal, to do it for that, but I just want to remind you of something else first. If you put A, that parameter, the angular momentum, identically to zero, it becomes exactly BTZ. You can get rid of the flat space. And so you should expect absolutely no drama at the horizon. And what you find when you calculate the norm of the tidal tensor is, this is in terms of the parameters, but when you push it through the quantization process, in terms of M1, N5, you find this volume and Planck length divided by root M1, N5. So for a big number of states, large N, There's no drama, no tides. What I want to contrast it with is what happens here. Now, my expectation was something interesting would happen only here, but there was a surprise. The presence of the cap gives you lots and lots of multipole moments of essentially of the cap in the in the throat region. And there are many of them. There's about 5 pages of Mathematica of them. But there's one really important one, which is going to be the dominant one. It depends on A, it depends on B, it depends on R, and E is the energy of the particle that you drop in. Okay, so now you drop it in from high up the throat. So you release it from here, or R is about B root N, and the whole point is that E gives you another factor of B, so you get B cubed. So then what happens is if you look at the geometric mean of the distance between the top and the bottom, and you put it through the quantized charges, and you choose the low values of the quantized charges, you suddenly find this tidal tensor is about the scale of your compactification or the scale of the Planck scale. So therefore, what this means is that because you've got ultra-relativistic speeds dropping in and a tiny, tiny deviation, this causes tidal forces to hit your Planck scale or compactification scale at around about halfway down the throat in the geometric mean sense. Not to be deterred, we also did the same thing. Neil and I have had this calculation. We haven't written it up yet. We're getting there slowly. Doing the same thing with radially falling string probes. And basically, there's a nice, very nice paper of Horowitz and Stief that you just follow your nose and do it the same thing here. Except one thing you need to do is, since everything's ultra-relativistic, you can use the Penrose limit. So that's what we did. When you go to the Penrose limit, you can actually do what you do in flat space, use light cone gauge, and the transverse oscillations depend on some mass parameter and the energy of the center of mass energy, essentially, which is determined by, in terms of the radial coordinate, which becomes time, so you get a time-dependent mass term. And in ADS and BTZ, you find this is identically zero for radially infalling geodesics. If they spin, something else happens. But so basically, no drama. When you do it in one of the superstrata, you find exactly the same physics. At large R, you find that this has 2 eigenvalues. This is an exponentially growing mode. And moreover, contrast it or compare with the tidal tensor. Basically, it's exactly the same term, the alpha prime P, the center of mass momentum or energy, turns up in exactly the same way. So the string feels this huge force halfway down the throat. So what it means is if you throw something in from the very top of the superstratum, it actually starts scrambling into the infalling matter about halfway down. So that's the picture. It's not the bottom that really kills you, it's halfway down. It's the tiny deviations of the multipole moments. I've got a homework problem to which I'd love to know the answer. What's the CFT joule of that statement? I'd love to know what the CFT joule of tidal forces is and tidal dissolution. Anyway. This is just purely scrambling the gravity. The particle's neutral, there's no interactions. We've cheated with the string, we ignored the B field. Well, in some of these geometries, you make the B field very, very, very small, except down here. You can localize it in the bottom. And then the gravity really does win. There is a really interesting case, which is very degenerate, where it's the N equals 1, where the B field is quite strong up the throat and it starts doing Landau-y things. But you can localize the B field as much as you like in the bottom, and then gravity really just kills it. Okay, so next steps and open problems. I've got about 5 minutes, I guess. Yeah. Okay. Six, oh, even better, I can say 6 things. Okay. Next steps and open problems. Okay, so with respect to this tidal thing, let me just be brief about this. It's kind of obvious. Supergravity, as we've learned over the years, has its limitations, but it is also a powerful tool. And one of the things it's very powerful at is giving you sort of hydrodynamic things of strongly coupled quantum systems, like the jet quenching story in quark law and plasmas. There's a very nice calculation Joseph just did with student Sasha Chukov doing trailing strings and looking at viscous drag. So what we're really talking about here is the tides dealing with energy transfer between the background and the thing that's falling in. And we'd like to do some back reacting of this, and in particular I'd like to use D1 brain probes instead, because they are in the background, and so it puts the background and the probe on the same footing. And so one of the goals next is to try and estimate the energy transfer in this tidal force and get an effective viscosity. Okay, again, the homework problem. Right, Now, the twisted sector story. Remember these coherent states that we now know the holographic dictionary for? Doesn't account for the black hole entropy, which probably shouldn't, because there are just relatively few of them. However, there's some really nice ideas out there, and there's an older idea which still hasn't been worked out, which is due to Masanek and Niehoff, called W brains. And the basic idea is, if you're old enough to remember how you get the heterotic string out of type 2 by wrapping brains, well, this is that game being steroids, on steroids. You wrap brains around these topological cycles, and you can get a vast number of microstates out of it, and order the right order to be the black hole entropy. There's a sense in which this is probing the Coulomb branch of the underlying CFT, but I don't have time to talk about that. There's another thing you can do, which there are when you have two unsolved problems on either side of the duality, there's always a temptation to think of them as the same. And so here, we have to look for twisted sector excitations, and we have some ideas about how that is a sort of condensate of magnons. But on the other side, there's this thing I alluded to at the beginning. The holographic dictionary for multi-centered story, the multi-centered geometries, we do not know. All I can say, really, is that you have a UV theory, and there's some holographic flow, and there's some very complex phase in the bottom, and you can load each of those bubbles with different momentum. We suspect they're magnon condensates, in a sense. But there's a lot of states in this system that we don't know what they are in the CFT. But that's sort of for the future. Okay, the thing I'm most excited about is, the problem really with the microstate geometry program is everything's zero temperature, with a few exceptions. I would like to actually be able to get some non-BPS or weakly non-BPS things. And for that, it's actually really useful to remember what happens immediately after Stromlinger-Wafer's sort of breakthrough. And that is to do near BPS. You take a big lot of left-moving QP, and you add a little tiny bit of right-moving QP. This thing is non-BPS because the mass is L0 plus L0 bar, number of left plus number of right, but the charge is L0 minus L0 bar, number of left minus number of right. The history of this is it worked really well at vanishing string coupling. There was a small Hawking temperature. Hawking radiation seemed to be correctly predicted by the scattering. Even the gray body factors worked. So it was a pretty nice piece of work. The thing to take away from this is it's beautifully controlled supersymmetry breaking. And all of this was done at G string equals zero. Thank you. So the question is, can we find this, or some version of this, at finite G string? And the important point is that the BPS story has given us the exact holographic dictionary to perhaps set this up. So here's the basic point. We know how to do that. That's what I've been talking about. That's a superstratum. But the thing that we've achieved with this holomorphic formulation is we can now localize these waves into a lump that sits at some point on the S1, highly localized. Now, a simple flip of the orientation of the circle means you can, of course, do that too. It has 4-0 supersymmetry, and you can localize that. So therefore, you can set up a scattering problem. And you can set it up with highly localized regions of left movers and right movers, and try and slam them together. Of course, when they slam together, it's going to produce a graviton and perhaps some Hawking radiation at a very, very low temperature, just like the work that was done after Stromlinger-Wafer. The important point is the fact that we've worked out the BPS with such precision means we can pose an exact initial value problem, or nearly exact initial value data for this. The nightmare is it still depends on 6 variables, and if you ask your average numerical relativist, they will start to gibber once you get more than 3 variables. But, So the options are the following. You can treat the left movers exactly and try and do some perturbation theory, or you can do numerics. As I said, it's a precisely posed initial value problem. The other thing that's really cool is you can do exactly the same computation in the dual CFT because you know what the holographic dictionary is, and there are some examples of this in rather simpler systems by Mathur and Bombini. Okay, but on the gravity side, it's still a bit of a nightmare. But there's a nice bonus. And this really goes back to ancient history. In the underlying thing I've been talking about, what you've got is an interesting set of harmonic oscillations on ADS3 and some harmonic oscillations on S3. But it turns out that if you look at the lowest harmonics on the S3, the very lowest ones, it is almost certainly a consistent truncation. I'll be about 2 minutes. A consistent truncation to a 3-dimensional supergravity. So we can actually set up a version of this problem by looking at this scattering entirely in terms of a gauged nonlinear sigma model that describes entirely the three-dimensional gravity here, and the miracles of gauged supergravity making the three-sphere degrees of freedom just go along for the ride. So in other words, the problem has been reduced to a problem of essentially three-dimensional supergravity, and that means purely scalar fields or a gauged nonlinear sigma model. That's much more doable. So let me conclude. So my sort of basic bone of contention is, if you want to understand microstructure and apply all that we've learned from holographic field theory and do sort of laboratory testing of microstate structures in the presence of gravity, you've got to use a microstate geometry. Superstrata, we now know exactly what they are dual of, and they're duals of the supergraviton gas. They have this beautiful cap BTZ structure. We have now perhaps the most general class of solutions of microstate geometries ever constructed, three arbitrary holomorphic functions of three variables. The interesting thing about informed tidal effects on this is that they happen high up in the throat, and I hope we can actually pull some hydrodynamics out of that. There's an important open problem, the systematics of twisted sector states. There's also, I think, for the first hope, a realistic way of getting at the most important problem, which is to turn on a little bit of temperature and see the really physical effects of having something that's actually more chaotic. The trouble with BPS is it's zero temperature. It tends to be frozen in many senses of the word. Okay, so we're important, but the other thing to take away is we're in the position to really hammer this problem now because we know exactly what the holographic dictionary is for the states, and we can localize waves and scatter them. You can compare it to CFT computations, and in fact, an old subject of gauged supergravity comes in, maybe helps you solve the problem. And my really last slide is really a reminder. Having started talking about elephants, I'm going to finish with the elephant in the room. And I'll leave you with that thought.
Doesn't the fact that these tidal forces become large, you know, halfway down the throat, limit the applicability of these microstate geometries?
Let me give you a glib answer, but I'll pull it apart. No more than a nuclear weapon invalidates the existence of a Swiss watch. Let me be very precise. So, seriously, the point is the following. This long deep state is extremely highly prepared to exactly replicate an incredibly low energy state in the CFT. And if you throw in an asteroid from a very great distance, it will hit that geometry and destroy it. But if you could drop it from a much lower height and actually study that process. So as I say, if you drop a nuclear weapon on a highly prepared state, it's going to be destroyed. It doesn't invalidate it. That is a perfect holographic dual of a very, very sharply defined state in the CFT. And if you hit it with something really hard, it will be destroyed. If you hit it with something soft, like you drop the probe from much lower down the throat, or you can dial the throat up higher if you like, you can actually do some calculations. So it doesn't invalidate it, it's just a reflection of the fact that the state is very highly tuned.
But maybe if I could just clarify, I mean, in your view, is a microstate geometry a classical solution of supergravity where, you know, curvatures are all less than the Planck scale?
Yep.
Yes.
So finish the sentence. You had a subject and a verb, but you didn't have an object.
I mean, I've heard other views from Samir that, you know, he would take a microstate geometry to be any sort of quantum
indeed,
state, which sort of extends out past the horizon. And
one of the sins of our slot is that we use the same terminology for three different things. I talk about microstate geometries where the supergravity approximation is still reliable. There's a thing called a fuzzball, which is this quantum goop. And there's something we defined in the middle, which is a microstate solution. So there is a lexicon which is badly and poorly used. But this is geometry where supergravity applies. The only issue you can have with this is when you start quantizing the phase space, could a quantum fluctuation change the geometry dramatically? And the answer is yes. But this is we've probed the bottom of this. The very deepest throats have an energy gap which is 1 over N1N5. They are the lowest energy states of the entire conformal field theory in the maximally twisted sector. So they're terribly delicate states. They're very low energy. And throwing in an asteroid will kill them.
Immediate follow up, wouldn't you worry that they're unstable as geometries, just dynamically unstable?
They're BPS. They've got a big, long throat. These things are fat. Those bubbles that you're dealing with are megaparsec and parsecs across. I mean, you know, you can make them big and fat. There is an interesting question about quantizing the phase space, but in terms of supergravity, no, there's nothing. They're all unstable. So there's Steve, I think.
Very interesting to see the tidal force calculation. This is one I think a lot of us have been wondering about for a long time. So a question.
Yeah.
If you think about the microstates that could correspond to a very large, very non-extremal black hole.
Right.
How close to the horizon do you think you get before you run into big total tidal forces? Do you have any new thoughts on that?
Not really, except for the following thing I'd say is, these are multipole moments, and there's a particular a squared b squared over r to the sixth multipole. If you had a suitably chaotic, complicated thing, you could imagine that maybe that would wash out that multipole. I have a student in France at the moment who's taking multi-centered ones, and I'm asking to try and kill as many multipoles as he can by arranging the bubbles, because I want to know whether this multipole is a universal thing, this a squared b squared over r to the sixth, or whether it's just a freak of the fact there's one cap with one bubble. And so your question is really, is it possible, I think, to have in a random ensemble with a sort of chaotic bubbles and things going on, these multipoles will wash out? And I think the answer is yes.
Well, that's maybe part of the question, or maybe, you know, if that doesn't happen and you come and get a large deviation in the propagation of matter, then
right.
You could even start ruling things out.
Indeed, okay, so this is slightly artificial because we're in the BPS story. So, but it's still
that's
halfway
why
down
I
the
asked
throat.
Highly non-extremal and very large.
Yeah, and it's also halfway down the throat. So what it means is it might, what I'd like to do is I'd like to calculate any corrections to viscosities of things falling in when you get very, very close. There might be some, if you think about it, if you really believe there's lots of microstructure at the horizon and stuff falls in and interacts and scrambles into it, it should produce a viscosity. It should produce some energy transfer between that. So I'm taking the models I know how to do the calculation and trying to do that calculation in an honest way. But the broader question is, take your favorite quantum system and ask, what's the energy exchange between microstates at the horizon scale? I mean, it's a really important question. Sorry, somebody over there.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Can you compute matrix elements of simple operators between these different states?
Between two different states, no, but there's... There's an awful sort of Stefano Giusto, Rodolfo Russo, and a bunch of other people have done a lot of heavy, heavy, light calculations of correlators in these backgrounds. In fact, when I sort of say we've really nailed the holographic dictionary down for these things, every time we produce a supergravity prediction, it's put through a really serious set of tests within the D1, D5 CFT, and it works every time. Smoothness in the geometry really nails down coefficients and Fourier expansions of different metric parts. You can test that by doing the correlation functions, and it works perfectly. You know, it's a lot of work to test one number, but you can do it. So what I'd love to do is have the thing you first asked, which is a heavy state, a different heavy state, and some light correlators. I would like to see a transition between. I have no idea how to do that. But.
You have a slide where you calculated the number of microgeometries in the context of Strominger-Wafa black hole. And you got a number which looks similar to their answer, but not quite.
No,
I want to understand. I thought the microgeometries, it's a continuous family of solutions. How did you count them?
Okay, so what we do is we do it in the dual conformal field theory. So in other words, let me just say it in words. So in other words, we know exactly what these states are in the dual conformal field theory, and then we calculate the partition sum of that. Well, Misaki does this. And then you look at the Cardi regime of that partition sum, and you do the usual game, and you find that it's down to QP to the quarter, not QP to the half. So in other words, these microstate geometries, the coherent ones we have, are really only a subset of the states. And we kind of knew that anyway, because we're looking at very, very particular CFT excitations.
Okay, so I understand if this is a CFT calculation, so it gives you the right result.
Yep.
But now once you know that, can you go back to the gravity and try to quantize it to reproduce it?
In principle, yes. There's some very nice papers that go way back to Jan de Boer, Masama, Elshuk, I can't remember all the people, Van Bleeken, where you can actually quantize the moduli space of the supergravity solutions. And for simple systems, it does actually reproduce what you expect from the CFT. For this class of solutions, nobody's even had the courage to try it yet. It's because the quantization of that phase space is very, very hard. If you throw away QP, put QP to zero, and put multi-centers in there, that phase space has been quantized, and it does match the expectations of field theory. But I'd love to quantize the phase space of this, but the only way I can count is by using the CFT side.
Other questions? Well, let me ask if you have, I mean, if these multipoles were affecting the infalling, yep, whatever, particle to the extent to have such large tidal forces, wouldn't you worry that if you deform the microstate from outside, mm-hmm, by having another dipole nearby or something, that similar effect would also take place?
What's the effect you have in mind?
Well, somehow you're changing the geometry just a little bit to screw up the precise.
Okay, so what's it's a good question. I mean, but if, okay, I can only answer this in the BPS context, and then I can just put multiple BPS solutions. Okay. So, but the broader point is that what's really blowing this thing up is the tidal force is there as a consequence of two things. It's the multipole and the fact you're encountering that multipole at the speed of light. So in fact, it's like, you know, it's like driving a Ferrari across a cobbled street. It just rips the thing to shreds. So there's this tiny deviation that is being amplified.
You have both of those, right?
Sorry?
You would have both of those if you deform the solution by
multi-center. The honest answer is I can deform the solution. I can turn in perturbation theory on this thing. We can back-react things that are BPS, and what we hope to do soon is back-react things that aren't BPS. And, you know, watch this space, and I'll step to the answer. You know, it might just be that I find, you know, I might, it's good science. I might find that I just create irrevocable singularities by doing that, and I go, oh, crap, I'm going to go home, I'll retire. But more seriously, the perturbation theory is really, and the non-BPS perturbation theory and its back reaction is very, very important. But I have faith that very small ones should back react into some interesting soup at the bottom of the microstate geometry.
Okay, Jerome, last question. Okay.
Yeah, there's other supersymmetric black holes with less supersymmetry.
Yep.
But as far as I know, no one's tried to pursue this program in that context.
Which ones do you have in mind?
They're black holes in ADS4.
Oh, ADS4, right, indeed.
So they have an ADS2 near horizon. Those black hole solutions of vehicles.
This is something I'd love to do, but there's something that drives me, you know. Once you start bubbling geometries and doing this microstate geometry program, the obvious thing to try and do is to say, can I do it in ADS2? As well. Can I take ADS5 and find new states of N equals 4, yay Mills theory in the infrared? I'm sure they're there in the sense of bubbling is this transition is a very local construct. So if you have a very small cosmological constant, of course you can bubble black holes in that geometry. And so therefore I believe this bubbling transition and the replacement of sources by fluxes can happen in any geometry so long as the curvature isn't too big. But what I believe is the obstruction is that the supersymmetry that is intrinsic to ADS4 and ADS5 hates the supersymmetry that's intrinsic to the BPS states I have here. And so that construction will necessarily break supersymmetry by some control parameter, which is the mass of the black hole related to the cosmological constant. And so I'm certain there are those sorts of geometries out there. It's just they're not going to be supersymmetric. And the sort of evidence for that is Harvey Rial's theorem that says there are no supersymmetric black rings in ADS5. If you can't have a black ring, you're probably not going to have a bubbling microstate geometry. Did I answer your question? No.
So for the degeneracy of the supersymmetric black holes, it'll be specific to this case,
yep,
that you can find a set of nice, smooth bubbling geometries, but for no other black holes. Is that what you just said?
I said that I don't know how to solve the problem once you put ADS4, ADS5 as the boundary conditions. I think it's intrinsically non-supersymmetric.
So
when you bubble it.
That's no, then.
Sorry?
That's no to my question.
Okay.
Okay, let's take further discussion to the break and thank Nick again.